Good morning and welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who are fed up with extremism and finger-pointing and want positivity, hope, ideas, and examples for how to make our world healthier and more productive and hopeful. Our guest today is Dave Ellum. He's the Dean of Land and Director of the Center for Working Lands at Warren Wilson College. But before we get started, I want to point out that today is National Puppy Day. So if you have a puppy, or even if you don't, love your dog, love your puppy, and maybe go out and get a puppy. Dave, welcome to the show. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm the director of the Center for Working Lands at Warren Wilson College, Dean of Land at Warren Wilson College. I'm actually a silviculturist by trade, a forester. Silviculture, what is silviculture? There will be a test at the end. Silviculture is the art and science of growing trees and forests to produce the goods and services desired by society. So what is that? Basically, I'm a forester. I grow forests for multiple uses, and I teach forestry at Warren Wilson College and oversee all of the land operations at the school. I'm actually a Connecticut kid, so I've been down here 16 years. Don't hold the Connecticut thing against me.
I'm from the other side of the sound.
All right. Port Jeff Ferry.
Long Island.
Yes, Long Island.
We get so much out of our morning introduction. Dave, what are the things that you're focused on and thinking about and working on?
Well, one of the things, when I describe silviculture as an art and a science, one of the things that I really focus on is the art. The science side of forestry, the science side of silviculture is something you can learn in a book. But the art of managing forests is something that you really can't learn in a book. It's something that you have to – time teaches you that. And one of the most important things about working with forests, with working with any natural resources, is the humility. You have to understand that the forest doesn't really care about you. And you're working in that forest, and you have to understand how that system works, your place in the forest, what you can do. You know, there's no problem with managing resources for humans from a forest. The issue is how do we gather and how do we nurture what we need from the forest while leaving enough for the forest to take care of its own needs.
So why is that important? Tell folks a little bit about that. When you use words like humility, and it's a forest, it's trees, it's wood, we build houses. What's the big deal?
Well, the big deal is this world actually is a world of forests with humans in it. It's not a world of humans with forests in it. And it's just the forests are our lungs for the world. Our forests are our natural resources for the world. They're also home for wildlife. And you can't just think of a forest as a timber resource for humans. You have to think about it as a community that needs to be self-sustaining and a community that actually persists into the future.
So what happens if we don't do that?
Well, I can get a little technical on you, and I'll try not to get too technical, but the idea is all forests, all natural systems are governed by natural processes. What I mean by that is every forest is co-evolved with the system and the area that it's in. And what we get into trouble with as humans is we don't understand the natural processes that govern forest growth, and we don't treat the forests as if it is a system that has co-evolved with that. And I can give you an example of that. And here in the Southern Appalachians, let me back up a little bit. There's no problem with cutting trees. I don't have a problem with cutting trees. It's when, where, how we cut trees that are the questions and why we cut trees. And so here in the Southern Appalachians, we got ourselves into trouble in the late 1890s through 1910s in the period of industrial logging. When we cut everything, we ditch clear cut this forest, and there's no natural process here in the Southern Appalachians that would have disturbed the forest in that way. And so what we did was throw off the dynamics of the forest. This is a forest, it's National Puppy Day, so I can use an analogy I use in class that this forest is like a mangy dog. It's patchy. If you think of this forest by natural systems here in the Southern Appalachians, it's a forest that has patchy disturbances, an ice storm here, pests there, fire, small fire over here. And so there's no natural disturbance that would take out thousands of acres at a single time. And so when we come into a forest and we actually manage it with large operations that clear large area of forest at the same time, we throw off the dynamic of that forest. And what we actually have here, instead of a very heterogeneic, multi-age, multi-species forest, is we've homogenized the forest into a single-age forest.
No, but so tell us about the implications of a homogenized forest.
We lose the species diversity. We lose the age classes. We lose the potential for carbon capture. And we just we homogenize the forest. And whenever you do that, you reduce opportunities for things like biodiversity, products, and ecosystem function.
Where did that happen? Like where, when you talk about the Appalachian Forest, where is that geographically from here?
Well, when we talk about from a biodiversity point of view, we're talking about the southern Appalachians, where we are here. And so, you know, when you stand in a place like Warren Wilson and you stand on a roof of a building at Warren Wilson, you look around, you're not seeing any old growth. You're seeing forests that's second, third generation forest. Unless you go down to Curtis Creek is about the closest piece of old growth forest. There's some old growth back there. So a lot of people see this forest and it's a beautiful forest, but what they don't realize is that the species composition has been reduced and the age classes have been reduced to a really homogenized forest.
Wow, never would have realized that. Thank you.
Sometimes it seems like we as people don't understand why diversity is important. Explain why we should care about the loss of diversity in the forest.
For me, it really boils down to resilience. A more diverse forest generally can be a more resilient forest. There are some examples of ecosystems that have very low species diversity that can be very resilient and stable. But for the most part, I mean, you know, it's kind of like human society. The more diversity we have in society, the more problems we can tackle because we have different mindsets. It's the same thing with biodiversity in a forest. If a pest comes through, if a disease comes through, if there's different disturbances, more diversity is going to allow for more resiliency in the forest.
So resiliency, does that mean it's able to protect itself or prevent a mass die-off? For example, an invasive insect comes in and kills off a bunch of trees. Does it protect against things like that? Or when you talk about resilience, what does that really mean?
Resilience, for me, in an ecosystem point of view, resilience means the ability to bounce back after a disturbance. You know, think of it as in agriculture, we think of this. If you're growing one crop and a disease or pest comes in that hits that one crop, you lost your whole crop. But if you have a farm, and this is something we're doing at Warren Wilson College, thinking about multi-crop, multi-market agriculture and forest systems, now if you have multiple crops and multiple types of diversity on your land and a pest comes through, you might lose one crop, but you won't lose all of your crops. And that's going to be really important for small landowners in the southern Appalachians to think about, how do I have a diverse market cropping system, diverse management system that can not only bounce back from disturbances, but also can supply economic returns and market crops throughout the year.
Can we talk a little bit more about that? That's interesting. I think there's a lot of folks in the area who have their own farms. Maybe they're small. And I think there's a lot of people who are also exploring expanding a farm or starting one, or at least a small or mid-sized garden, call it. So tell us a little bit more about the work you're doing in that area and how that's going.
Great. So Warren Wilson has about 1,000 acres of land, about 1,100 acres of land. About 300 acres of it are our central campus. But we also have about 250 acres of cropping lands, pasture and crop lands. And then if you ever drove through, we also have about 650 acres of forest land, which is about 1 square mile of forest land. So we're really a microcosm for a small to medium landowner who has some built environment. They have some cropping systems, some farms, but they also have maybe a woodlot, maybe a forest area there. And so what we're looking at Warren Wilson College through the Center for Working Lands is having Warren Wilson College serve as a research and a demonstration area for small landowners who want to do alternative cropping systems and a diversity of cropping systems to protect land, to keep land in the family, to keep land in the farming community, but also to help folks make a living. Because let's face it, folks who work the land in this area in western North Carolina, many of them might net less than $10,000 a year off of their land. So that's one piece of it. Another piece of what we're doing through the Center for Working Lands is trying to bring novel and innovative cropping systems to western North Carolina and landowners. And what I mean by that is, if you're a small landowner and you are doing something that works but you'd like to make a change, it's really difficult because you might be paying notes on your equipment, you're might be sending your kid to college, you're paying notes on your land, and to make a change could be very difficult due to risk. What we're doing at Warren Wilson College is trying to assume the risk for landowners by trying novel innovations through our students and through research. And then we can assume the risk of testing these operations. And then once we have the data and the information, it's a little bit easier to disseminate that knowledge out to landowners. So we want our land and our students to serve as a resource for demonstration and the dissemination of innovative land management practices.
So it seems like just as you want a diverse forest because it's more resilient, you're helping local farmers develop land that's more resilient and farms that are more resilient, and also allows them the opportunity to sell more crops or different kinds of crops and different kinds of things. Is that where you're headed or what's going on?
It is. We think that small landowners, I believe, now be careful, I'm a Connecticut kid, so I've been here 16 years. It's going to take me a little while to understand the system as well as folks that have grown up here, especially those that have grown up here generationally. It's not only a matter of bringing economic returns, bringing diverse systems to people so they can stay on the land. It's also protecting the rural culture of Western North Carolina. The rural culture of Western North Carolina is tied to the land. It's very important to folks here. This is an area of the country. I've been all around the country. Those of you who might be listening in other parts, excuse me if I get your blood up, but I find that Western North Carolina and the Southern Appalachians is still a place in the United States where people's whole fabric of being and communities are still very tied to the land.
Can you give examples for folks?
Think about this area with medicinal plants. We have folks that are called Galackers, and those are folks who collect Galax, which is a very important cultural forest plant in the Southern Appalachians. Sangers, people who collect ginseng, people who have been on the land for generations who are really tied to that land. And what we are trying to do is understand projections say in the next, by 2050, we might have some projections saying a 30% increase in population in Buncombe County in this area. What's that going to do to our land base? And if we lose our land base in Western North Carolina, what is that going to do to the fabric of our rural communities? How do we not only bring economic value and resource value through diverse operations to small landowners, but I also see it as a land conservation tool. We lose a lot of land in this area because people can't afford to keep their land. So how do we provide opportunities for folks to keep their land so that we keep the fabric of rural communities?
So why can't they keep their land?
A lot of it is taxes. This is something I try to get through to the younger students I work with at Warren Wilson. It's easy to drive by a for sale sign on a piece of forest land and think the people that are selling that land just don't care. They're greedy. They don't care. That's not always the case. There could be lots of folks who own a few hundred acres of forest land in Western North Carolina, and they're not getting any economic value off of it. Say their timber's not due for another 40 or 50 years. They're not getting any economic value off of that land, but they're paying taxes. And that tax burden may be such that they can't afford to keep their land. And that land might be in their family for generations. And the insidious part is, some people have to sell 10 acres here, 20 acres here to help pay for the rest of it. And before you know it, you're left with a housing lot with development around you. One of the programs we are working on at Warren Wilson College is something called Guaranteed from Seed, Never Wild Harvested. My passion, I talked about being a forester. My real passion is forest understory plants, the little green bits that grow on the ground. What we have is a program with our students at Warren Wilson College called Guaranteed from Seed, Never Wild Harvested. The majority of the plants that are in the medicinal plant trade, and Western North Carolina, Southern Appalachians are a hotbed for medicinal plants. These are high-value medicinal plants. You'll know some of these names: ginseng, black cohosh, golden seal, Solomon seal, blue cohosh. These are all plants that are in the medicinal plant trade, and a majority of them are wild harvested, which is reducing biodiversity on lands, and it's also causing some problems with resiliency. What we are doing at Warren Wilson College is growing these plants only from sustainably harvested seeds, which no one else is really doing. It's a difficult project. It's a difficult process. But we grow these plants from seed. We grow them for 2 years. Then we make them available to landowners to put onto their property for economic value down the road. So now you could have somebody with forest land. Their timber might not be due for 50 years, but they can have a rotational crop of some of these high-value medicinal plants that they can harvest every 5 years. And I'm not talking about getting rich. This isn't about getting rich. For some people, that's not what we're doing at Warren Wilson. What we're doing at Warren Wilson is providing these plants at a scale that will at least make the land revenue neutral by covering the tax burden. And we feel if the land is revenue neutral, it reduces the incentive for folks to have to sell land, and it keeps people on land. It also gives them the ability to keep that rural fabric and that rural fiber together.
So you're helping, like you said, to preserve the historical cultural fiber of the region. And some people are opposed to all the development that's going on. So it seems like you're doing a good thing for the community.
I think that, but the other thing that I heard that would probably tie in is that that also helps to support the diversity, because the more space there is open for all different kinds of things, the more opportunity for diversity. Is that accurate?
Are you talking biological diversity?
Yeah.
Yeah, the biological diversity, it does two things. It can increase the biological diversity on folks' land that don't have these plants, and it will protect the biodiversity on the lands that people are harvesting these plants from. You know, you think about it, people think that ginseng is this really rare plant that's really difficult to grow. It's not. The funny thing we say, well, it's not funny, but what we say is the hardest thing about growing ginseng as a crop is not having it stolen. It's very easy to grow. And in fact, if you go back to some of the old botanist travels like Bertram from centuries ago, you are walking through fields of ginseng. The reason there's no ginseng on land right now is because it's all been overharvested because it's such a cash crop. So how can we protect wild populations while bringing that economic value to landowners? And economic value, I've seen a lot of forest land in a lot of countries, and I can tell you right now that some of the best managed forest land that I've ever seen is forest land that brings economic value to the landowner. I do not think it has to be one or the other. I think you can have economic value and protect biodiversity, aesthetics, wildlife.
What are some of the barriers to this kind of diversification and building resiliency in either the forest or on farms?
Great question. So for a lot of folks, it's the economic constraints of managing land. Let me back up a little bit. It's a little bit different for forests versus farms, because farms are much more intensely managed. Farms are on one of our old farm managers I got into a talk with. I did not grow up on a farm. I grew up a feral child in the woods. I was talking to one of our farmers. I don't know if any of the listeners are farmers, but I said, boy, I don't know how you all do it, because if you sleep in one day on the farm, the wheels come off. You can't sleep in. And he looked at me very straight and he said, Dave, I don't envy you foresters, because you have time to stop and think about what you're doing, which was really, you know, how you think about it. They're two very different processes. For, you know, I would actually argue that for both of them, though, it really boils down to economics. You know, what are the economics of running a farm? What are the economics of owning forest land? And how do you get past those economic constraints? I can give you an example of one project we're working on right now at Warren Wilson to try and relieve some of the economic constraints on small farmers. And that's a project that we're working on with the Critical Services Microgrid Group, which is a pro bono group here in Asheville, on something called agrovoltaics. And agrovoltaics are the process by which you can actually integrate solar panels into an agricultural system at a density, spacing, and orientation that allows you to still farm your land. We like to call it farming the sun twice. You actually farm the sun for your crops, but you also farm the sun for the energy. And what we think is that if we could demonstrate the usefulness of agrovoltaics, and again, I want to make sure it's clear, we're not talking about covering 100 acres with closely packed solar panels and putting gravel underneath them. That's not what we're talking about at all. That's for me, that's a land conversion. What we're talking about is some really interesting innovations where you can have, they're actually making cattle fence, which is photovoltaics. So the fence actually absorbs sunlight and use it to run the operation. You can put these panels up high enough that you can run tractors under them. You can graze cattle under them. So we are getting ready to look into installing some agrivoltaics on our land. And now, what if the farmer was able to produce their own energy and be reduced and have their energy costs reduce, and not only have their energy costs reduce, but also move towards solar-powered equipment, which would reduce greenhouse gas emissions from farms and benefit the entire planet? So that's one example of untethering farmers from electricity costs from the grid, which not only helps add resiliency to their farm because they're paying lower costs for their energy, but they're also contributing to reducing greenhouse gases.
You know, you've been just talking about so many interesting things and things that you seem to be partnering with farmers and people have their own land. How can people get in touch with you or to find out more information about the programs that they might be interested in participating in?
Yeah, that's great. So the Center for Working Lands is being developed over the last couple years, and we're ready to roll this out in April. So starting in April, we'll be rolling this out. Anyone who wants to contact me to understand what types of adult education, workshops we're doing on the property, speakers we're having coming in, can contact me at Warren Wilson College. My email address is D as in David, ELLUM. At warren-wilson.edu. Also, if you go onto Warren Wilson's homepage and you look up faculty, you can find me. The last name is ELLUM. The whole purpose of this initiative that we're rolling out is to engage with landowners in this area. And we're not only talking large farmers and forest owners, we're talking homeowners, because we're also developing what we're calling five solution areas at Warren Wilson College through our land, through the Center for Working Lands. And these solution areas we've developed along three parameters. What are some issues that the world needs solved? What are some issues that our students are interested in? And what are some issues that Warren Wilson can do well, given our land operation, our experiential learning, and our work program? And the five solution areas that we're going to be focusing on are climate-forward agriculture, food justice, land and habitat conservation, ecological landscape design, and sustainability leadership. So when I talk about ecological landscape design, what can a small landowner that has a half an acre in Asheville or an acre outside of Asheville, what can they do around native plants? What can they do around protecting from releasing greenhouse gases? What can they do for helping to protect bears, to have bear-human conflicts reduced? Bear-human conflicts, in my opinion, are usually human conflicts, not bear-human conflicts. this center that we're developing will not work unless we have engagement with landowners in Western North Carolina and Southern Appalachians. So I'm really hoping folks who are listening contact me and say, hey, Dave, not only do we have this problem that we need solved, but hey, we have information that might be able to contribute to the center. It gets back to humility. Just because I have a PhD after my name doesn't mean I know everything. I need folks to come and say, hey, these are the issues that we have. Can we work with you on that?
Do you feel like the community is open and listening? These are great. Your five focus areas are really great. What's uptake like and interest?
It's growing. We have something called the Conservation Exchange, which is our newsletter that we sent out. And I can tell you the interest here in Asheville and Western North Carolina. How do we engage with the general public? And about 3 years ago, I went out. I said I really wanted to find out who has needs and what those needs are. So what I did was just hang a sign on some of our trailheads saying, hey, next Thursday, I'll be available if anybody wants to come see us. And just talk, I'll be there. And if you want to hear about our land, that was 2.5 years ago. I had about 45 people show up for coffee. It was great. We talked. We got to know each other. That was the start of the Conservation Exchange, which now goes out to a little over 2,000 folks. Goes out about every 6 weeks, and it explains what we're doing. It talks about projects and how folks can get involved. So there's great involvement. We're also working with the Appalachian Beginning Forest Farmers Coalition to hook up with landowners who want to see some of these guaranteed from seed plants.
Is that publication available online?
I actually send it out online. Yeah.
Okay.
I send it
out, and if somebody wanted to get that, they would contact you as well?
They would contact me. I would put them on the mailing list, and they would get that. The next one will be out about June 3rd, because for Earth Week, Earth Month, Earth Day, we're doing a lot of speaker events, a lot of community events. So folks should get a hold of me soon.
So tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that I would call it a movement faces.
I'll tell you right now, one of the things that we have to get past right now, change is coming. Change is coming. We have no choice. Change is coming. Do we drive that change, or do we let the change drive us? And that's one of the things. I don't know if any of you have ever come into contact with Warren Wilson students. I'll put our students up against anybody's students. Our students are mature. Our students are passionate. Our students care about the world, and by golly, they're going to solve these problems. And at Warren Wilson, we have students that are not content with letting the challenges drive them. They want to drive solutions. So that's going to be one of the big issues. Can we get ahead of some of these issues and not let the issues take over? We can drive those issues. The other challenge for change right now is it's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult to make the changes we have to make. We've just also developed solar vehicles on campus. One of the cool projects we're doing is converting old golf carts that have lead acid batteries, and converting them to lithium iron phosphate batteries. Lithium iron phosphate is important because the iron, instead of lithium ion, doesn't use cobalt, as much cobalt, so it reduces some of the conflict metals. But where I'm going with this is, these, we call them mobile microgrids, are actually self-sustained solar vehicles that actually have power on them that our work crews can use on campus. And they're a little more difficult to use because you can't park them under a tree. They're solar. You have to clean the solar panels. So you have to start thinking about, it used to be with some of these golf carts, you park them wherever you want and you get back on them. Now all of a sudden you have to pay attention to where you park. Every now and again you're going to have to clean the solar panels. And we can't get into a place where you say, well, I never used to have to do that. You never have to used to do that, and that's why the world is in the situation it's in. So we have to get into this mindset where we have to make changes, and we can't say, well, this is more difficult to do. It's just that this is a different way of doing things. And I think that's one of the biggest, you know, from a 30,000-foot view, that's one of the biggest challenges is changing our mindsets.
So you mentioned earlier, I think the percentage you said was 30% growth.
The numbers are all over the place.
Right.
But this morning I looked because I thought it might come up, and some of the numbers say Buncombe County about a 30% growth, you know. If you look at broader...
In people, right? In population.
People, if you look at broader demographics, Western North Carolina, inland New England, and the Lake States are three of the places people are coming.
Trying to create a little urgency might not be a bad idea. It's difficult. What's the consequence of not taking it on in light of this potential growth, or in light of just the change in climate?
There are social challenges. There are many challenges. From my point of view, from what I understand and what I do, the biggest challenge that I see from the change in demographics in this area is going to be the loss of green spaces. And this is where I started off this conversation, development. Development, development, development. When people move here, and we're going to have the loss of land and the loss of rural livelihoods. From my perspective, I think that is going to be one of the biggest challenges to this region, is not only the loss of land, not only the loss of green spaces that add wellness to humans and biodiversity for wildlife, but also the loss of the Southern Appalachian and the rural culture in this area.
So let's assume all these people come to escape from whatever climate misfortune they're facing. And let's go back to the farms that you're working on creating, which are going to be resilient, diverse. They're going to allow the farmers to keep the farms, and because they can pay their taxes. And yet all these people are coming in, and developers are going to want to develop the land. How do we work through that?
For folks who are listening or are thinking, boy, yeah, maybe I do have a few hundred acres, and maybe I do want to figure out a way to protect it, but I don't want to manage that land. Because there's some people who own land, and that's not their primary focus. They might work in Asheville. They might do some other things. Another great way to protect land and reduce some of your tax burden would be conservation easements. Putting land under conservation easement, I can give you an example from I worked at a land trust out in Orange County, out in the Raleigh area. And conservation easements are a way to keep your land but reduce your taxes by selling your development rights if you have a piece of land that you don't want to develop. Or, you know, one thing that people get confused about with conservation easements are a conservation easement isn't a thing. It's a legal document that's written between you and a third-party land trust. So you could have 500 acres and say you want to put it under conservation easement, but say I want to hold this 20 acres for future development for my kids. So you can do all that. You can still timber. You can still do research as long as it's written into it. We had a dairy farm in Orange County that was about, it had been running for about 80, 90 years, and million-dollar houses were being developed all around that dairy farm. And so that dairy farm was being taxed as if it could be sold for million-dollar houses. And that dairy farm was about to go under. What we did through the Triangle Land Conservancy was put a conservation easement on that land so that the farmer was still able to run his dairy farm, but his taxes went down as undevelopable land. And so his tax burden was reduced because he didn't own the development rights anymore for it. He didn't want to develop it. It was already a farm. And that was one way to protect that land. So conservation easements are a great opportunity. There's Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy in this area. There's Conserving Carolina. And there's numerous smaller operations that could help you put some of your land under conservation easement.
So I know you don't have a crystal ball, but you do have a lot of good experience. Based on your experience with farming, with forestry, knowing that the potential for a lot more people to come here as they escape whatever climate situation they're in, what have you seen will happen if we don't conserve the land, if we don't build resilient farms, if we don't build resilient forests? What kind of an outcome could we expect if we just let these things happen?
Yeah, one of the reasons folks want to come to this area is we're really buffered from right now from a lot of climate issues. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, but there's a wooden desk I can knock on. You know, we don't really have tremendous wildfires in this area. That could change. Flooding, we're starting to get some flooding, but we don't have the flooding like we do in the Midwest here. We don't have hurricanes hitting us very often. We don't have a lot of tornadoes. So right now, because this area has still a lot of intact ecosystems, it's pretty safe from some of these natural disasters. If we start developing the land, putting in more impervious surfaces, if we start developing more land, more hard surfaces, if we start channelizing rivers, if we start doing all the things that come with development, we're not going to be buffered from a lot of these wild fluctuations in climate, and we're going to see more natural disasters in this area. It's going to happen. And again, I keep coming back to this unique ecosystem that humans are part of in this area. And I believe we're going to lose what's a really important culture for this area in the long run.
Everywhere you look, it seems that someone is coming in and tearing down everything on a lot or tearing down the side of a mountain to build some complicated tiered structure somehow plastered into the side of the mountain. It's just sad to see it.
So it seems to me that if we continue on the path in Asheville and probably any area that has a natural beauty, the logical thing will happen is that it will no longer be beautiful. So the intent is to build out this, you know, to come visit here and see its beauty and to experience its natural beauty, and then we're going to develop it and it will go away and it will cease to be. That seems like a potential outcome.
I think that's something that happens all the time.
As long as there's precedent. I mean, so I just want people to think about that. Like, this isn't news. This isn't breaking news that this happens. This will happen.
And it's hard to not be hypocritical because I moved here from Connecticut, right? So it's not what we're doing. It's how we're doing it that really needs the focus. How are we doing this? And are we getting ahead and thinking? I think that domestic climate refugees are something that should be on everybody's tongue right now, and you don't hear a lot about it. You don't hear the people who are studying it, but we don't hear a lot about it as something that we should think about as a planning tool. I want to be careful. Some people might be listening and saying, I'm writing my dissertation on that. I agree that there's some people thinking about it, but it's not common language right now that this country is going to experience domestic climate refugee crisis over the next 100 years. People are going to shift around. It's going to be global, but it's also going to be within our country, and it needs to be on the tip of everybody's tongue.
So, Dave, I want to go back in the minutes we've got left. Go back, if we could, to those five focus areas you've got and some of the things. Let's talk about real examples of the kinds of things you are looking at Warren Wilson.
Great. So what we're doing at Warren Wilson, again, the Center for Working Lands. The Center for Working Lands is a living, learning, and working laboratory in the Southern Appalachians. What we're really focused on is using our land, our students, our faculty, our work program. We're one of the 9 work colleges left in the country, to really think about how we can build a more resilient and inclusive world through land stewardship, education, and research. And again, we're really focusing on 5 solution areas. Those 5 solution areas, one more time, are climate forward agriculture, food justice, land and habitat conservation, ecological landscape design, and sustainability leadership. So a few of the concrete examples of projects we're working on at Warren Wilson College that we would love to get engagement with a broader community on. On our farm, a lot of people might not realize this, but Warren Wilson College was originally the Asheville Farm School. So on our farm, we do grass-fed beef, we do pasture-raised pork, we do both wool sheep and meat sheep. And one of the things we're looking at is folks talk a lot about agriculture and farming from the point of view of industrial agriculture and its effects on climate. But we believe there's a place for small-scale appropriate agriculture. And on our farm, we're starting to investigate no-till agriculture. No-till agriculture is a process by which you don't till the land every year. And the tilling process is the same as your compost bin. If you do not turn your compost bin over time, you don't get the decomposition of the organic matter. Well, that's because you're adding air to it. And the process of decomposition of organic matter is CO2 into the atmosphere. So by not tilling your land and by doing no-till practices, you can actually plant without tilling, using the past crop, the debris from the past crop, to reduce weeds and also to as a natural mulch to keep in moisture to reduce water use. Some people are starting to look at it as a pretty common practice in larger systems in the Midwest, but we've developed funding to purchase a no-till drill so that we can start looking at no-till agriculture, testing it for this area, and seeing what crops it works with. As part of that, we're also doing a very direct and intense carbon analysis of all our agricultural soil carbon, because we want to sequester carbon in our soil. And so we're teaming up those two things to understand how are we sequestering CO2 carbon in our soil, and how do our management practices help with that or detract from that. So that's one great example we're doing. The agrivoltaics is another great example of a farmer supplying their own energy on campus to reduce costs and reduce greenhouse gases from the grid. One of the really exciting ones, I don't think we have a lot of time, so I'll talk about forestry, and boy, we should have another show the way I talk about forestry. But on our land and habitat conservation, we are really thinking about how do we bring smaller scale economic value into the forest that supplements timber value. We're developing a truffle orchard on campus, so we're trying to understand if truffles can be grown in Western North Carolina. Janine Davis is also doing that through some of the North Carolina Cooperative Extension. We're tapping our walnut trees. That's an interesting one. So we tap our walnut trees for walnut syrup, which is a high-value niche crop that landowners can get into. We do shiitake mushrooms on campus. That's another way to, again, land and habitat conservation, bringing economic value to landowners. So that's another operation we're doing. Food justice is one that we really need to lean into as a community. Asheville is considered the foodie capital of this region, but you don't have to look around to see the food insecurity in the area. So what we're doing is our garden. We have a 6-acre row crop garden, and we're completely reworking our allocation away from a CSA towards our cafeteria, and the bulk of our food produced on that garden we want to put into food insecurity in the region. We are developing the college garden into what we hope will become a hub for food justice in Western North Carolina. Growing food, teaching about food insecurity, but also developing conferences and lecture series around food justice and food security. So those are a couple of the concrete examples. Our most aspirational work we're doing is around ecological landscape design. And this really ties into the idea of land loss. If we're going to protect biodiversity, if we're going to have human wellness, human health and wellness, if we want to conserve energy, our built environments are going to play a huge role in that. How do we integrate green spaces into urban and suburban areas that are aesthetically pleasing for people, that can conserve energy? Why don't we have food forests in our built environments? Why don't we have food forests in our cities? Why aren't we planting more fruit trees? Energy conservation, where you plant your trees in an urban environment can affect the amount of energy usage in those environments. So these are some of the things that we're working towards through the Center for Working Lands at Warren Wilson College. And again, I can't stress it enough, this center will not work unless we engage with the community. And I'll tell you right now, you want to engage with our young folks that are doing this work.
You know, Dave, I want to build on that for just a second. You brought up something that I think was striking, which is the idea of it's difficult. What would you say to folks who kind of wilt a little bit because it's going to be hard? What's at stake?
You know, I don't want to boil it down to this one thing, but it's going to be difficult to make some of these changes, but it's imperative. It's not like we have a choice for some of these changes. Business as usual is not going to work now. You know, people ask me, how do I stay positive in this? Thinking long term, foresters have to think long term. Think of it as a forester. One of the things that I have to deal with in life is that if I start a forest stand and I want to grow oaks out there, I will never see if it was successful because it takes 100 years to grow from an acorn to an oak tree for timber. So I'm in an operation where I have to have faith, right? I have to believe in the work that I'm doing, and I have to believe not only in the work that I'm doing, but I have to have the humility to believe that the work that I'm doing is more important than whether I get direct benefits from it. And I think if you have this mindset, this long mindset of, you know, the future and what you can do, I think it makes the difficult tasks a lot easier. And, you know, for me, all I need to do is drive down the road and look at some little kid playing. And that's my incentive of saying, yeah, this might be difficult for me and I might not even actually see the results of this. But it's going to benefit the folks that come after me.
The other thing that strikes me is that all the technological advances we've had have evolved over thousands of years. There was a time when we as people were freezing cold and we needed jackets. And we didn't go and get L.L. Bean jackets. We figured out over time how to make a jacket or a coat from an animal skin or to use all these natural resources. And it was hard. And so I often wonder if we can do this because we've kind of proven that we can do this kind of thing over centuries. We have proven to be resilient people. And it's all that people really did was say, I need to eat. I wonder if I can grow something. And they didn't know it was going to come, but we did exactly what you're talking about, it seems to me, which is, I know this is going to pay off in the long run because it's going to keep me warm. You know, people learned how to make fire. Well, why? You know, it's these evolutionary things. And all we're saying is let's get out in front of it as opposed to waiting for it to be a burning platform where survival's at stake.
Or being so complacent to say, well, you know, I don't need to worry about that because I have a job or I have a house or I just plug things in and the heat comes out.
We always lean on technology and we talk quite often about scaling up. How do we keep scaling up? How do we keep scaling up? You know, I was talking with a friend of mine the other day who brought up a great point. What about scaling down, right? And I don't mean making your house smaller and getting rid of stuff. While that could be important for many of us, you know, this agrivoltaics is a perfect example. Technology scares people. when we think about fossil fuels, technology is going to have to play a part in how we get around burning fossil fuels. But it doesn't have to mean always bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, scaling down, this idea of agrivoltaics is scaling down for a farmer, scaling away from the large utilities, the large centralized utilities, to smaller technological operations and installations that can actually benefit the farmer. So it's a matter of, I see that as kind of scaling down, thinking about smaller community-based initiatives rather than always thinking about these huge, we got to get bigger and bigger to solve our problems. And I think that's going to be important.
There's a lot of good work in local communities to get things done. And it's true, a lot of your best societies, if you think about the societies that are truly prosperous, where there's a feeling of inclusion and discussion and everyone's fed and everyone has plenty to do and no one's marginalized, they're all very small cultures, and they could be in India or different parts of the world. And it is when people scale. It is when you scale that you lose that. And so I think there's a huge opportunity for us to focus on local. And we say it when we sort of shop local, but it's live local. It's use energy locally. And there's clearly scale comes into play when you get into business because you need more customers. So that's probably what we're up against and how we got here. Dave, we've got to go. Thank you very much for your time. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you have a great day. It's National Puppy Day.
National Puppy Day.
All right, folks. Have a great day.
Take care.